morning. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Wednesday, the 5th of June. One of our guests this hour writes, "The notion of bringing vanished species back to life, some call it de-extinction, has hovered at the boundary between reality and science fiction for more than two decades. Science, for the most of that time, lagged far behind the fantasy. We are at the moment when science has caught up. Humans might gain the ability to bring back an animal they have driven extinct." And, of course, there was news recently. The de-extinction movement got a boost with the discovery of a well-preserved mammoth that was complete with flowing blood and muscle tissue. This hour of the program, we'll talk about the whole movement, if it's a good idea or a bad idea. We have two guests with us. Ben Novak is one of our guests, and Ben is a research and science consultant, project manager of The Great Comeback, which is a revive and restore initiative under the Long Now Foundation, working with de-extinction scientists all over the world to build a roster of potentially revivable species. Ben is an expert in ancient DNA and says he is obsessed with reviving the passenger pigeon. He was hired to work full-time on that project, starting with sequencing its nearest living relative, the band-tailed pigeon. Ben, we thank you so much for being with us. It's going to be a fascinating hour. Hi.
Hello.
Hi, Ben. Thanks. Carl Zimmer is also joining us. Carl is a columnist at the New York Times. His column, Matter, appears each Thursday, reports from the frontiers of biology, where scientists are expanding our understanding of life. He's written all kinds of books about science, Soul Made Flesh, A History of Neuroscience, At the Water's Edge, a book about major transitions in the history of life, The Smithsonian Intimate Guide to Human Origins, Parasite Rex, written hundreds of articles for the New York Times, National Geographic, Time, Scientific American. He's a lecturer at Yale University, where he teaches writing about science and the environment. Carl, thank you so much for being with us.
Pleasure to be here.
And we're going to be welcoming phone calls as well. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org. And our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. Carl, let's start with you. We are at the moment when science has caught up.
We're pretty much at that point, yes. I mean, actually, there are scientists right now in Australia who have been working with an extinct species of frog, and they have been able to get so far as to produce viable eggs of those extinct frogs that are starting to divide into embryos. Now they're trying to figure out how to get those embryos to go all the way to adulthood. But that gives you a sense of just how far we've come.
And what about this major discovery of this well-preserved mammoth? A lot was made of the flowing blood and the muscle tissue. Does that move us many steps forward for some reason? And if so, what's the reason?
We don't actually know yet if that moves us any further forward. It's an amazing discovery if it turns out to be authentic. I mean, this actually hasn't been published in a peer-reviewed journal yet.
Oh.
There only been news reports, but they're coming from researchers who are very well-regarded for their science and collaborate a lot with scientists in the United States, for example, and other places. So there's good reason to think that they really have found what they have claimed. But, you know, the question of whether there's stuff in that liquid blood that you could use to bring mammoths back from extinction is a separate question. For example, I mean, red blood cells, it's important to remember, have no DNA in them. So you can't use a red blood cell to bring a mammoth back. There are other cells in the blood, of course, the white blood cells, and they do have DNA. But then you have the question of whether that DNA is still viable, whether it's still intact, or whether it's just been shattered into lots of pieces. The nicest thing would be to pluck a cell out of that blood and put it in a petri dish and let those cells start to grow and then use those for cloning. That would be the ideal scenario, but, you know, it could just be that these cells are just kind of vestiges of their former self.
Mm-hmm. Ben, you are passionate, I have read, about passenger pigeons, and you would like to bring them back. Let's ask for the history of when and why they became extinct and why you want to bring them back and how you're going about doing that.
Well, the last passenger pigeon, a very famous individual by the name of Martha, died in 1914. It's one of the few species that heralds the exact hour of their extinction. She was found at about 1 p.m. on September 1st in her aviary at the Cincinnati, Ohio Zoo. And sightings of passenger pigeons had been incredibly rare since the year 1900, when arguably the last individuals were actually shot in the wild. One individual is held to be known as the last individual in the wild, and that's Buttons. Buttons is actually on display in Columbus, Ohio.
Oh.
An individual shot out of a flock of mourning doves by a 14-year-old boy, actually. But the species was really in decline between the 1860s and 1900, and the total system collapse occurs about 1880 to 1890, where you go from still having about an impressive number of potentially 2 billion birds in 1880 to having merely a few thousand
in
1890. And that's one of the reasons that people such as me and others who study extinction and study extinct species are interested in studying the bird. But it's also one of the reasons that they're very famous, as they represent possibly the most severe population decline in written history. And that decline is, especially what we're finding now with what we're researching, that decline is definitely caused by human-driven means.
And is that true, Carl, of the other species that are undergoing revival projects? They became extinct because of human activity?
Well, it depends on which species you're talking about. So, I mean, there's been a lot of work being done on mammoths, actually, because the places like Siberia, they're actually amazingly well preserved. So we were just talking about the liquid blood that may have been found from one. I mean, scientists have found samples of muscle tissue and other kinds of tissue from woolly mammoths and other places. And we actually can get a lot of DNA from woolly mammoths, from these tissues, and we can actually kind of figure out what their genome sequence is. I mean, there's even woolly mammoth DNA in the dirt, believe it or not. So it's a great species to work on to test out these possibilities of de-extinction, if that's what you want to do. But exactly what the role was of humans in their extinction is actually a subject of a lot of debate. There's people are arguing whether humans just wiped populations of mammoths out, or whether it was more a process that was involved in the changing climate at the end of the ice ages. That's a big debate. So, you know, that's an important issue when you're trying to talk about the ethics of de-extinction. You know, should we only limit ourselves to species that we know for sure that we drove extinct, or are we going for something else? Are we trying to restore habitats to the way they used to be, say, 10,000 years ago?
Mm-hmm.
In any case, we're not going to be bringing back Tyrannosaurus rex. We don't even have to talk about that, because there's just no way to get the kind of materials, the gene sequence or anything like that, that would make that possible. So fortunately, we don't have to have that debate.
Where do you fall on that, Ben? Do you think we should only be bringing back species that we drove extinct?
Well, this is where it's... I find the question to be a little abstract yet, as to should we or shouldn't we, because of some of the other limitations on this science that are actually a little larger and eclipse that notion. So as Carl brought up, we can't even begin to try and get dinosaur DNA. And the truth is, we can't get really viable DNA past about 1 million years, based on its chemistry. It'll break down. Even if it's really well preserved in Siberia, at about 1 million years, it's going to start breaking down beyond the point of being used. And this is based on it being kept cold and well preserved. And so you might be able to get a 500,000 year, an 800,000 year old piece of DNA in Siberia. but you'll struggle very much to get something that's even just a few thousand years old out of Florida or Mexico. So the gradient of environments on the planet preserve DNA in very different ways. And unless we can get the DNA, then we can't even discuss whether or not we can bring a species back. So that's one limitation. And another limitation is with the current state of science is if we can re-engineer a genome and we can produce viable cells of an extinct animal, we may not be able to get those cells into a surrogate mother and have them be born. So something like the giant ground sloth has no surrogate parent that's capable of raising the offspring, or elephant bird of Madagascar. Mm-hmm. And so there are actually plenty of species that humans have potentially caused the extinction of that we can't bring back, and potentially some species that we did not that we can. And so in trying to push the science forward, we don't have all of the choices we would like. But in the ideal sense, the candidates that we're looking at for the extinction are species in which we do know the extinction cause, because that way we can actually confront whether or not that extinction cause has been removed so that that animal will be viable and still be able to exist, whether or not that the animal's habitat and ecosystem can sustain that animal. And that's the more appropriate question is, you know, do the factors of the species extinction actually lend towards its de-extinction being a positive or useful thing mm-hmm. to the modern world?
Mm-hmm.
And in the last few thousand years, at least the last 1,000 years, you will be hard-pressed to find a species that has not gone extinct due to some type of human factor, either hunting or introduced species or habitat loss and disruption.
Carl, in your article for the National Geographic, the April issue, Bringing Them Back to Life, you write about this meeting that took place at the Society's headquarters. Geneticists, wildlife biologists, conservationists, and ethicists all gathered to talk about de-extinction. Could it be done? Should it be done? I'm interested in what all of those minds had to say, if there was great disagreement about this, or if there was a common thought that, yes, we should do this for these species, and these are the reasons why.
It was a really fascinating meeting.
I imagine.
A lot of these people had been working on their own in isolation, in a sense. And so to bring them together, they could talk and actually realize that they were working in the same direction, and they had kind of complementary skills. So, for example, there was an amazing account of the first attempted de-extinction, which took place about a decade ago when Spanish and French researchers tried to revive a wild mountain goat called Bucardo. And they actually were able to deliver a living baby Bucardo, but it only survived for about 10 minutes because it had very serious birth defects. But it was the first time anyone had been able to do that, but he hadn't really been able to figure out how to go forward from there since then because it's so much work. And at the meeting, there were other scientists there who were describing all sorts of amazing advances in cloning technology and in stem cell research that could really make it much, much more practical for this researcher to try again to bring the Bucardo back. So that's one of the reasons that we're having this whole discussion about de-extinction, because it's not science fiction anymore.
Mm-hmm.
The thing is that, cloning has gone so far, and also sequencing of DNA, that technology as well, is so cheap now that you can start to really talk about this as a scientific proposition. But as Ben was saying, and I want to reiterate, it's still not a walk in the park. I mean, there are so many hurdles to bringing back a passenger pigeon or woolly mammoth that, we still don't know whether it could actually happen.
And those scientists who spent so much time, as you described, bringing back the Bucardo, short-lived as it was, did this for what reason? Why did they spend so much time?
Well, they had been struggling for decades to try to keep the Bucardo going, you know, as a subspecies or a species, and their numbers had been dwindling down. But you know, they had saved some tissue from the very last one that was alive in the wild, and then sadly they discovered that last Bucardo was dead. And so, you know, they basically said, well, you know, we can't do any more conservation, but maybe we can try this. And maybe this could be something that could be useful for other species that we haven't been able to preserve. I mean, this is conceivably, this is a way that you can extend conservation biology. You know, when conservation biologists are trying to keep endangered species from disappearing, when that species goes extinct, that's it. The game's over. So perhaps this kind of extends the amount of time that conservationists can try to preserve species. But as Ben said, you know, you have to have a place for that species to be able to exist in order to make all of this effort worthwhile.
You also make the point, and an important one it is, that there may be that biological diversity is a storehouse, you write, of natural inventions. So we have all these pharmaceutical drugs that weren't invented from scratch. We went to natural compounds found in wild plant species, which are also vulnerable to extinction. Is it easier to deal with wild plants?
There's so much that we have yet to learn about the biological diversity of the world, and there's so much potential there. And as you say, I mean, many of our medicines come originally from compounds that evolved in wild plants. Our antibiotics come from fungi and from bacteria. And, you know, we're not smart enough to think of these things on our own. We can't just go into the lab and draw out a molecule and say, ah, this will cure cancer. What we do is we go and take advantage of 4.5 billion years of evolution and that kind of natural experimentation. Every time that a species becomes extinct, we don't get the chance to see that experiment. And we're missing out. And because species are becoming extinct at such a rapid rate, we're losing more and more of that sort of natural warehouse of knowledge. And just to give one example, this frog that I mentioned that scientists are trying to bring back, it's called a gastric brooding frog, and it does this amazing thing, or I should say, it did do this amazing thing.
Yes.
The females would swallow the eggs and incubate them, brood them in their stomach.
Oh,
and
my gosh.
These frogs would hatch from their eggs inside their mother's stomach and develop into a larva and then into little adults, and then the mother would actually just vomit them out, all these live frogs.
Oh, my.
Yeah, scientists refused to believe that this was real when it was first discovered in the 1970s. And so, you know, reproductive biologists have said, you know, there's something really interesting going on here. With hormones and control of a stomach, which should be usually just a little acid bath, there are all sorts of fascinating things going on. Maybe this could help us in terms of human fertility. If we could just study it, but we can't because it's extinct.
Mm-hmm. We will ask Ben in a moment. He was given the assignment of reviving and restoring the passenger pigeon project. How do you restore a passenger pigeon? I'm just wondering, as he sat down to begin his work, what did he do? What's he working on right now? How do you have that happen? We'll welcome phone calls as well. I would imagine we'll have more than a few on this. We're talking about the de-extinction movement, and we have two guests with us. Carl Zimmer, who was just speaking, is a journalist and author. He's a columnist at the New York Times, contributor to National Geographic magazine, and wrote a highly interesting piece, cover story of the magazine's April issue, Bringing Them Back to Life. Ben Novak is a research and scientist, project manager of The Great Comeback, which is a revive and restore initiative under the Long Now Foundation, and he was hired to revive and restore the passenger pigeon project. Our phone number, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. 866-866-5555. Email, if you'd like to use that, is talk@WPR.org. Our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. Or you can also tweet us at K Dunn Show. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Hour two of our program, former Senator Olympia Snowe, who recently left the Senate, she had a long career in state politics and also in Washington, D.C. She concluded that serving in the United States Senate was no longer worth the time and effort. She believes that there is something terribly wrong in Washington, and it is imperative we return Congress to something more closely resembling the institution she joined in 1979. Former Senator from Maine, Olympia Snowe, hour two of our show. Let's go to phone calls. We have many of them coming in. Mike in Milwaukee, our first caller. Gentlemen, hi, Mike.
Hi, Kathleen. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I'd like to see the 15-foot-tall elephant bird of New Zealand brought back, as well as the Tasmanian tiger, both rendered extinct by humans. But the Tasmanian tiger was considered a pest and raided human livestock, which led to their extinction by humans. So you would still have that livestock predation issue if they were returned. And what about the issue of introducing a pre-21st century animal with a pre-21st century immune system into a 21st century ecosystem plagued by global illnesses and viruses? And I'll take any responses off the air.
Thank you, Mike. Who wants that? Ben? Carl?
Go ahead, Ben. If Carl will let me, I'd love to step in for a moment.
Sure, go ahead.
Well, these are all things that we're considering in our designs. For starters, I would point out that many animals that go extinct prior to 1960, and especially those that go extinct prior to the 21st century, fall into a very, very odd category of knowledge, even in academics, that a great deal of what we consider facts or accepted knowledge about these species stem from folklore and very, very misunderstood situations, primarily from the cultures that were first encountering them. The Tasmanian tiger, for instance, right now, from the standpoint of Michael Archer and many others that research the species, they haven't been able to find any major conclusive evidence that it ever actually attacked sheep, and that escaped convicts killing people's sheep and eating them may have actually been the major source of what those those accounts are coming from. And it's very easy for us to demonize one thing as a pest or not. On the other hand, the disease question, now that's incredibly pertinent. And it's something that's been brought up several times. And that's an instance in which when we bring back the extinct species, say the passenger pigeon in my account, we'll analyze the differences between immunological genes between the living species and the extinct species to see if there are differences that have adapted in the last century. And we will borrow those differences from the living species. We have to be conscious and responsible of that, and the fact that these species have missed out on a few generations of evolution that they would have encountered. And we're going to be accounting for that and researching that. One such instance in which we want to actually tamper with maybe changing the immune alleles completely fall in the case of Hawaiian birds that have been exposed to malaria that never had any immunity to it, is borrowing immunity from birds from a different continent and putting into those birds, such as William Powell has now done with the American chestnut tree by introducing a gene from wheat to make the tree resistant to the blight that made it nearly extinct in the early 21st century.
We have messages coming in on email and Facebook as well. A Facebook from Lawrence. Let's give this one to you, Carl, before we go back to phones. I wish we would just leave nature alone, especially when it comes to woolly mammoths. This will come back to haunt us. Scientists should focus their energies elsewhere, such as curing diseases.
Well, we haven't left nature alone for tens of thousands of years, so I'm not exactly sure how the listener thinks we're going to stop now. you know, I think that we have to figure out some kind of coexistence with the world's biodiversity. And that doesn't mean that we just somehow disappear from nature, because, you know, we depend on nature, and we are creatures of nature ourselves. So, you know, de-extinction might be part of that solution. Certainly, I don't think anyone is saying that it's the only part of the solution, though.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to Dick next. Dick is in Art River, Michigan. Hi, Dick.
I might have missed a minute or two with the screener, but the passenger pigeon is an exceptional example of a social species that will never be allowed or bred and released to be in the wild, an ecosystem. It needs hundreds of millions, so it would be only for captive experiments, and otherwise they just don't can't exist in our ecology, except in the hundreds of millions, which won't happen. Thank you
for the call. You agree, Ben?
I disagree 100%. Mm-hmm. And this is because this falls into another one of the notions of poor science that has been done in the past. And our research currently actually differs from this. I'm glad it was brought up, because this is the biggest misconception about the passenger pigeon, is that it has a critical population size that is very, very large, possibly hundreds of thousands to hundreds of millions. And there are actually no accounts to support this historically, due to several problems that can be a bit lengthy to go into. But one account that's coming out of our research from the genetic aspect of analyzing their genetics is there's actually potentially not the population structure within the species to support that they needed hundreds of millions of birds, but the fact that they were at the population size they were, flocks of hundreds of millions, 2 billions, was completely dependent on the actual resources available, and that a species today would be adaptable to the resources that are available. And the species is actually very, very opportunistic when it comes to the forest plants that it eats, and it is not dependent on any particular type of tree mast in the forest. So my forecast for passenger pigeons being viable, and I think everyone's actual scientific forecast, should be that it's actually very, very possible. And this has been agreed upon actually by several other experts on the bird, as well as experts in the captive breeding of colonial social species, such as, oh, well, I probably shouldn't say names right now.
Why not?
Because several of these scientists are not official partners of the project yet. It would be premature to list them.
Okay. Let me give the phone number again before I ask my question. 800-486-8655 is our number. 800-486-8655. A couple lines are open for you right now. We're talking about the de-extinction movement with two wonderful guests and welcoming your thoughts on all of this. It's probably, I don't know, we'll ask maybe Ben knows about this, but I would imagine that that 14-year-old who killed the last passenger pigeon, Carl had no idea that he was killing the last passenger pigeon. We do get news stories now that there are certain species that are close to extinction, and I'm wondering if we also need to focus a good deal of attention on the fact that we could keep doing this over and over, because it's my understanding there are a lot of species that could be gone 20 years from now, 30 years from now. So we'll have to always, if we decide to go forward on this, keep this de-extinction movement going for animals that are becoming extinct now.
So for the past few centuries, the rate of extinction has been way above what you see in the fossil record going back millions of years. So, you know, human activity is definitely driving species extinct at an increasing rate. And there are a number of species now a huge number of species that are endangered. Their populations are much smaller than they used to be. In some cases, we know that there are just a few individuals left. I mean, there's a giant soft-shelled turtle in China, the Red River soft-shelled turtle, that there are only four left.
Oh, my, four. Oh, where are they?
Two of them are in a zoo in China, two of them are in Vietnam, and none of them are mating. So, you know, this is an example of a species that's functionally extinct. And there are, unfortunately, many, many other of these examples. And, you know, scientists are trying to look forward and say, like, well, what's going to happen if these endangered species become extinct? And, you know, will climate change and other things that we're doing accelerate that? And, you know, there's reason to worry that we could be entering a period of mass extinctions on par with what wiped out the dinosaurs 65 million years ago. I mean, that's not an exaggeration. There's no way that, at least with, you know, the technology we have now, there's no way that de-extinction could stop that. We could pick out a couple species and try to bring them back, and that would be that, you know, the value of that conceivably might be that it might sort of focus people's attention on the broader extinction crisis. But if you were to try to bring back thousands, hundreds of thousands of species from extinction, you'd be busy for a long, long time.
Yes, I would imagine. Did the press make anything, or did the world know when that 14-year-old shot the last passenger pigeon? Ben? Whoops, are you there, Ben?
Oh, sorry, Ben.
Oh, yep.
Yeah.
Yep. Oh, no. If Carl will know the history as well. But yes, there was... The extinction of the passenger pigeon was well followed in the Eastern press. And you know, it was not documented at the time as being the last passenger pigeon shot in the wild. It was documented as an account of a passenger pigeon in the wild, because at that time, just finding one in the wild was a serious account of note. And it wasn't until several years later that it was recognized as being potentially the very last one.
Hmm. Let's go to William in Appleton. Hi, William.
Hi.
Hi.
Yeah, I've got kind of a practical question, I guess. I got to find out how they can rationalize the benefits from bringing back a woolly mammoth against all the homeless people we have and all the dread diseases we're facing today. It seems a little immoral that we would try to do that and ignore those people.
Ben?
Oh, Carl might be the better person to take this question. I, of course, would have my own input, but...
All right, Carl, you want to start? I want to hear from you too, Ben. But, Carl, what do you think?
Well, I'm not sure that we should be making our decisions about what's the right thing to do to be a kind of a total zero-sum game. You know, if you were to take that approach, we should cancel the space program. We should cancel everything that doesn't give us some sort of immediate, tangible benefit. And the fact is that actually, you know, science often brings us benefits that we don't know about when scientists are actually doing the research at the time. There's case after case of this where scientists are exploring sort of basic questions about the world, and then up pops some very interesting, useful thing. So I think it would be a mistake to say, well, I can't see the value of this right now, so we shouldn't do it. And I would point out, you know, in the case of the mammoths, that, you know, there have been some people who have argued that if you could bring back woolly mammoths, that you could actually use them to engineer the ecosystems in Siberia so that they would change back to more of a grassland and would actually be able to store more carbon than they can today. And that actually would have a benefit in terms of climate change.
Oh, that's interesting. Yeah.
That's one possibility. And certainly, you know, I don't mean to diminish the fact that conservation biologists are dealing with limited resources. You know, conservation biologists who are trying to keep species from going extinct, you know, from poachers and trying to save habitat and so on, they're really strained. And so it would be, I think, a bad thing if somehow resources were taken away from those efforts to go into this de-extinction research. But that's not really how it's working.
Ben, do you know what the benefit would be of bringing back the passenger pigeon, or are you learning what it might be through all of the research?
Well, all of the research that goes into it has diverse and many benefits. Trying to get one back into the wild does have some ecological benefits. That is one of the reasons that we're very interested in the species. But if I could step out of the passenger pigeon for a moment,
sure.
To be, you know, maybe slightly provocative here in addressing the question, as you know, why don't we focus on our efforts on clothing and feeding the homeless? I would point out that the money that goes into the production and televisation of one National Football League game could feed and clothe the homeless of an entire state. Yeah. So society puts its priorities where it chooses to put them when they vote for congressmen, when they put their money into the charities they decide to, and when they do certain things. And this de-extinction topic, it's a discipline coming up as a tool for various types of research. It's not some sort of end-game tool, as Carl put it, and it's not some type of major distraction from the other things we're researching. And on the same level, why do we put money into researching cancer when so many people could never afford cancer treatment? Policy on how we use these things and what society does with them is very different than the industry of how we research them and do these things.
Thanks very much for the call, William. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. We're talking about the de-extinction movement, and it's really moving ahead. As I've said, one of our guests wrote in the National Geographic cover story that he wrote back in April that humans might gain the ability to bring back an animal they have driven extinct. It's no longer science fiction. The science has caught up, and it begs some very profound ethical questions, but also draws our attention to keeping other animals from going extinct and has us thinking about how we might be able to deal with some current problems if indeed some of these animals are brought extinct, as brought back, as the mammoth situation referenced by Carl Zimmer, one of our guests, journalist and author, columnist at the New York Times, contributor to the National Geographic magazine. We reference his article, Bringing Them Back to Life, on the cover of the magazine's April issue, which I believe is on our Facebook page in case you'd like to read it. It's a good read. And that is the Catholic Kathleen Dunn Show. Ben Novak is also a research and scientist, consultant. He's project manager of The Great Comeback, which is a revive and restore initiative under the Long Now Foundation. And he is working, he knows about other species as well, but he was hired by Revive and Restore to work full-time on the Passenger Pigeon Project. More phone calls in a moment. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Shortly after she announced that she would not seek re-election, Bob Schieffer on CBS's Face the Nation said this, March 4, 2012, "What does it say about the state of our government and politics when serious people like Olympia Snow conclude that serving in the U.S. Senate is no longer worth their time and effort?" That's the part that should worry the rest of us. Former Senator Olympia Snow joins us the second hour of our program, author of Fighting for Common Ground, How We Can Fix the Stalemate in Congress. Back to phone calls. We're talking about de-extinction, the movement this week, and we go next to Marion in Wisconsin. Hi, Marion.
Hello.
Hi.
Thank you. My question?
Sure, go ahead.
Okay. If you managed to bring back one passenger pigeon, it would be one sex. How would you breed them?
Ben?
All right. Well, this comes down to what was mentioned is what we would get to talking about earlier is, you know, how do we actually plan to do it? What I will say is the largest area of our research right now, that's the challenge area, is producing that first passenger pigeon. But if we can produce one, we can produce two. And that's the overall design plan, is we will not actually be producing one passenger pigeon at any point in time that will be by itself. we will be producing what we consider an initial flock of passenger pigeons. And one advantage that this initial six or eight or so passenger pigeons, even though that's a very low number, one advantage these passenger pigeons would have, say, versus the final surviving species of a currently endangered species, is that we are actually choosing and designing what type of genetics come back. And that comes off a little full of hubris at first. And what I should mean is, when we analyze the former passenger pigeons that used to be alive, from the hundreds of samples that are available, we'll be able to see very distinctly related individuals from different genetic families. And we'll be trying to replicate individuals from these families. That's what we're choosing in the genetics, so that we have 6 to 8 individuals that are genetically distant, so that when they breed, there's no worry about inbreeding, and they combine new alleles and produce different variants when they breed. And the one advantage we have with passenger pigeons as far as their social structure is that their actual behavior and social structure seems to largely come from juveniles forming their own social cohorts independent of their parents. So in the 1800s, when passenger pigeons would breed, two parents would produce one offspring, typically, and you'd have a flock of this massive flock of 100 million or up to 1 billion birds, and they would lay their eggs, the eggs would hatch, they'd feed the babies until the babies were nice and fat, and then all the adults would make mass exodus away from their children, and I'm sure there are plenty of humans that could want to do that every once in a while. But anyway,
okay.
Leave the babies, and the babies are actually left in their nests 2 to 3 days before they're capable of flying. And this is a very unique behavior for birds. And so the juveniles would then form their own juvenile flock, and at some point in time, they would join an adult flock later when they witnessed one. That's the idea. And so in trying to create passenger pigeons that breed and work well, we get to work with the knowledge we have from breeding other pigeons species. We've bred many types of exotic pigeons successfully, and we're actually going to be experimenting with band-tailed pigeons, who also breed colonially as surrogate parents, and rock pigeons as potential surrogate parents as well. And actually, certain types of pigeons, rock pigeons and Nicobar pigeons, have been used to raise the offspring of completely different species of pigeon, sometimes differing in size, not just color, by amazing degrees. And the offspring, when they're raised by different parents, as far as pigeons are concerned, seem to still fit into their own social cohorts very well.
Thanks very much, Marion, for the call and for the great response. Carl, you mentioned the possible environmental benefits of a return of the woolly mammoth and the fertility benefits of that gastric brooding frog. With limited resources available, when you listen to all of these scientists and geneticists and ethicists all over the world, it would seem to me as though there must be a hierarchy of what would be most important for the world right now to bring back. Some species may be more valuable to us than others. Is that right? And is there talk about that? And the second question is, what would you be most excited about having returned?
Well, certainly conservation biologists who like the idea of de-extinction are actually discussing this, coming up with some kind of priority list. I mean, what would be the most valuable things to bring back? And, these would probably be species that played an important part in their ecosystem, and now their ecosystem is not doing well as a result. I mean, if you take top predators out of an ecosystem, that disrupts the whole web of species because they're not eating their prey, and now they're more of their prey, which may then go and eat other species. So top predators actually, in some respects, may be good to bring back if you don't get where, if you can be sure that they're not going to cause some sort of, you know, other harm. So there are these kinds of ways of setting that up. But in terms of, you know, what the limited resources, you know, it's a tricky thing because, you know, right now scientists like Ben are just working out the very basics of this. And you know, if it's possible to get the process of de-extinction down to actually start having some successes, chances are that it's going to go from being very expensive to a lot less expensive. If you look at biotechnology in general, costs go way down. It is vastly cheaper now to sequence DNA than it used to be even 5 years ago.
Uh-huh.
So it may not be that big of a deal. But in any case, if I got to say which one we need to bring back first, I would say, and with no regard to practicality, I would say the Stellar Sea Cow, because it's like a manatee, except like the size of Tyrannosaurus Rex, like 30 feet long, and it lived in the North Pacific. We drove it extinct. We ate it, basically. Sailors would kill them for food, because you could feed a whole ship for weeks at a time on one of these things. And they're just magnificent. And they would cause zero harm if you brought them back. It's not like they would become invasive. And it would just be amazing to go and see these gigantic 30-foot-long manatee-like things, these stellar sea cows. Unfortunately, I have no idea who would be the surrogate mother for one of these things because, you know, ordinary manatees are maybe a third the size of it.
Stellar sea cows.
Yep.
Will you send us a picture of one?
Oh, absolutely.
Thank you. We'll put it on our Facebook page so we can all share your dream, or some of us can share your dream. Bill in Madison, hi.
Hello. I see three things about bringing back something like a woolly mammoth. I mean, I know we've got a sample that's in really good condition, and so it's an obvious place to start. And as much as I would love to see the magnificence of one of those creatures alive today, their natural habitat was subarctic, you know, Siberia, North America, you know, Canada regions, and those are regions that are warming up. And so we'd be putting them into a world that increasingly would be hostile to them in terms of their climate. And two, there's the you know, their closest living modern relatives, the Indian and African elephants, are already being hunted to extinction by poachers who want their ivory. Can you imagine the ivory prize of mammoths?
We have about a minute left. Ben, you want to take this?
Yeah. Well, first I would like to we'll break this down. The political aspect of the ivory, I feel, is the most important part of that question when it comes to mammoths, because it comes not down to ultimately, you know, are they going to be poached and hunted to extinction for their ivory just like elephants, but also do we spare mother elephants to raise mammoths when we have a problem with elephants?
Mm-hmm.
So there's, you know, that's a very heavy consideration to take into account when it comes to environment and the survival of the mammoth. This is another case in which the science has just not been properly disseminated. So mammoths lived in climates that were actually much warmer than today. They survived several hundred thousand years of ice age to glaciers melting and the climate warming back up, and then ice ages again. These are animals that have actually undergone vast climate changes before. And the tundra, which we associate with the Arctic now, the tundra and taiga, are habitats that have shown not to have existed prior to the last ice age, because in between each ice age before, you had mammoths and bison and large herbivores living in that area, maintaining a prairie environment all the way up to the very most northern tips of Siberia and the Yukon. And one of the reasons we think that mammoths are an interesting species to bring back is Sergei Zimov has actually shown that when you introduce herbivores into the tundra, you do get that prairie environment coming back.
Fascinating. Gentlemen, thank you. It was really an interesting hour. We have to go, but thank you. I loved it. Our guests, Carl Zimmer and Ben Novak, Carl's piece in the National Geographic in April, and he's going to send us a picture of what he would like to see again, the stellar sea cow. I want to see one of those. And if you go to our Facebook page, we have very interestingly put a picture of my interviewing a woolly mammoth. I think it's funny. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning and KP Whaley for producing this hour. We'll be on this subject again sometime. And another hour is coming up. Stay with us.